Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. National defense spending says a lot about how a country sees the world and its role in it. American military spending is huge. It dwarfs all others. In some ways, it defines what we are and what we are not. It's an issue as big and real as they come. The next president will have giant choices to make. Yet it's barely discussed on the 08 campaign trail. This hour, On Point, another real issue for 08, U.S. defense spending, what it should be and what it makes us. Joining me today from Washington is Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He's also a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Larry Korb, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Daniel Goree, vice president of the Lexington Institute during the first Bush administration. He served as director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness for Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Dan Goree, thanks very much for being here today.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
Larry Korb, Dan Goree, we've been doing an occasional series on kind of real issues that perhaps aren't getting the attention that they might or being framed as clearly as they might be on the 08 campaign trail. And this is a giant one. We're going to look at a very high altitude at this issue of national defense spending and also get down into the nitty-gritty. I know the two of you have very different perspectives, but it's as big an issue as there is out there. And Larry Korb, I wish you'd just dive in by framing up for us where U.S. defense spending stands now in historic terms. We saw recently, you know, the highest number in real dollars or constant dollars since World War II. On the other hand, it's a smaller percentage of our GDP than it's been at different points. How do you describe the scale of U.S. national defense spending now, Larry?
Well, I think you put it very well when you said that in real terms, that's adjusted for inflation, it's higher than it has been at any time since World War II. If you add in the cost of the war to the baseline of the normal defense budget, it exceeds what we spent at the height of the Korean War and also the war in Vietnam. But I think what's really troubling about the budget as you look forward is this administration basically punted. They didn't make any hard decisions, and they're projecting that over the next 5 years, the defense budget will not grow in real terms, and that's impossible given all of the programs that they have in the budget. It's also true that if you take a look at the percentage of GDP that's devoted for defense, it's lower than it was during the Cold War on average. But our GDP has grown quite substantially since Vietnam. And my view is that you should take a look at what you need rather than saying we're going to allocate a fixed amount of GDP to defense or any other agency.
So are you saying in that we're spending enough, too much, not enough?
Well, I think we're spending too much, and I think there are things you could do to bring it down. This is the baseline budget, exclusive of the war costs, because I think we're still building too many weapons that were originally designed to deal with Cold War type of threats or major conventional warfare threats.
Dan Goree, how do you describe the scale and shape of U.S. defense spending today? Big enough, not big enough, and deployed correctly or wrong somehow?
Well, in fact, it's not enough. We are the only country in the world with the kind of global commitments, global alliances, global responsibilities, the desire to, in a sense, be there for our allies, our friends, for tsunami victims in Indonesia, earthquake victims in Pakistan. And we've come to realize, I think, over the first Bush administration, the Clinton administration, and now the second Bush administration, that this is a military that, by and large, we like and we use a great deal, not just in Iraq or Afghanistan. And if we like it, if we use it, if it's necessary and important for our security and that of our friends and allies, then we should be willing to pay what it costs to maintain that military. And historically, we don't always do that. A lot of times we under fund defense. We did that during the Clinton administration, the result being that when you get to a war, you suddenly find yourself with 30-year-old trucks, 40-year-old aircraft, 50-year-old submarines, and have to go through a crash program to buy back the readiness and capability that we lost in these downturns.
Dan, here's a question. How can it be? Now, I know we've spent more in terms of percentage of GDP in earlier eras and conflicts, but how can it be that we hear all the time about a broken military, about worn-out equipment, about, you know, I mean, the U.S. Air Force here described by a top general as geriatric? How can we be spending so much and then turn around and be told, your military is in lousy shape, America?
Because, in fact, we spend on a lot of different things, some of which are not war-related. For example, we've got the largest number of lawyers of any military in the world. We've got battalions of lawyers. Well, they clearly do a good job related to a variety of issues, but they don't contribute to the military capability of the nation. We spend, frankly, more on health care than virtually all the other nations of the world.
For our military personnel, you're saying?
For the military personnel. Mm-hmm. We spend on daycare. About two-thirds of our military personnel now, because it's volunteer military, are married and have kids, and we spend a huge amount on daycare.
We should treat them like Chinese military families or, for that matter, Iraqi?
Absolutely not. And that's the point. If you're going to treat them as Americans expect to be treated and as we want to treat our military personnel and their families, then you have to pay the price. And for those who want to talk about making tough choices, is it the choice between medical care for the military, training for the military, or war equipment for the military? Which are we going to give up in the name of fiscal savings?
Lawrence Korb, Dan Garay says this is a military that Americans like and Americans use. They expect to have this kind of planet-straddling capacity, you know, sort of whenever and for whatever reason it's deemed necessary. And this is just what it costs. In fact, it should cost more than this, Larry.
Well, I think, again, you have to take a look at what capabilities that you need in the 21st century. For example, we still have 6,000 nuclear weapons. There's no reason for us to keep that many nuclear weapons. You could easily go down to 1,000, or as former Secretaries of State Shultz and Kissinger and Secretary of Defense Perry and former Senator Sam Nunn, Chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, said, this is ridiculous to have this many. Not only will you save money if you go down to about 1,000 instead of the nearly 6,000 you have on alert, but will make you more secure because you'll be setting an example for the rest of the world. And similarly, when you take a look, I mean, Dan mentioned it, you know, under the Clinton years, Bill Clinton actually spent more on defense than the first President Bush had projected on leaving office. But he didn't make wise decisions. For example, the first President Bush and then Secretary of Defense Cheney wanted to cancel the V-22, this tilt rotor Osprey that takes off like a helicopter, flies like a plane that costs over $100 million a copy. Clinton kept it there in order to curry favor with certain constituencies in Pennsylvania and Texas. So what happens is you're finally getting this, you know, after, you know, accidents and delays and cost overruns. But meanwhile, the Marines didn't buy other helicopters, which, you know, they could have used. Similarly, as Secretary of Defense Bob Gates just said, you know, the Air Force is obsessed with getting the F-22 aircraft, which, you know, again, will cost you about $350 million a copy.
This is the successor to the F-15. Everybody's saying if you want to be able to belly up to China as a potential challenger at some point, you've got to have this super high-tech new jet fighter.
That's right. And Secretary Gates said, you know, how many missions has it flown in Iraq and Afghanistan? And rather than buy, well, right now we bought 183, you could easily have bought less than 100 as sort of, you know, to keep in the closet unless you needed it, and then bought lower, like the F-16, which we're still selling around the world, and even countries like Israel are buying. And then your fleet would not be as old. So I take a look at this year's budget, for example. The Air Force, you know, wants another 20 F-22s, but they didn't put any money in their budget budget for the C-17, a transport plane that you need to get your troops to theaters like Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever else you want to go. So I think it's not a question of money. I think it's a question of poor choices that have been made over the years. And I agree with Dan. We ought to pay our military personnel, because what we've done is we have undermined the whole volunteer military, which was never constructed to fight a long war. That's why we have people register for the draft, since we decided not to do that. For example, we're spending over $1 billion a year just to get people to join the Army in this unpopular war.
Dangaray, could it be then? It's not that we're not spending enough. Lord knows we're spending more than the rest of the world's countries combined, but that we're not making, as Larry Korb says, the tough choices, that we're just keeping everything on the table, whether or not it really makes sense now.
Well, in some cases, the tough choices that he refers to really means to accept inferior equipment or equipment that isn't up to the competition that we may face at some point from a China, a Russia, an Iran, or whoever. And so we have made the decision. We're doing it now, for example, in buying these mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles, the heavy armored vehicles
for Iraq.
For Iraq, that we want superior military capabilities. We've got F-15s that you can't fly anymore. They've been grounded because of age-related wear. Same thing happening to a large part of our F-16 fleet. So when you look at what it might mean a decade from now, 20 years from now, to have to go through a confrontation with a China, perish the thought, but it may happen. We can't predict these things very well. I don't want the U.S. Air Force to have planes that are no better than and possibly inferior to those that the Chinese are flying.
I want
the United States Air Force to have the best.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about another real issue behind the 08 presidential campaign, America's giant defense spending, now at its highest in constant dollars since World War II, asking how much should we spend on defense and for what? Daniel Gray joins us. He's vice president at the Lexington Institute in Washington, former director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Defense Department during the first George W. Bush term. Lawrence Korb is with us, former assistant secretary of defense under Ronald Reagan, now senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. I want to put in our ear the sound of a couple of earlier presidents who both paid a lot of attention to matters of defense. First to Dwight D. Eisenhower, of course, who led Allied troops during World War II, then turned around and very late in his public life to warn about the military-industrial complex. Here he is in his final address as president, January 17th, 1961, warning about the growing military-industrial complex. He had called it the military-congressional-industrial complex, and looking at the consequences, as he saw them then, of increased military spending on the nation's economy.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
A warning from the outgoing president and former big-time general Dwight Eisenhower in 1961, and this from a guy who should know. Here, then, is Ronald Reagan delivering his first inaugural address January 20th, 1981, 20 years later, saying the U.S. military must always be prepared for potential conflict.
Our reluctance for conflict should not be misjudged as a failure of will. When action is required to preserve our national security, we will act. We will maintain sufficient strength to prevail if need be, knowing that if we do so, we have the best chance of never having to use that strength.
Dan Garay, Lawrence Korb, let's look at these two presidents and their messages right there. First to you, Dan Garay. Dwight Eisenhower knew a bit about war and the military, and yet there was that famous warning as he left office. Do you see the danger today of a military-industrial complex sort of warping our military spending? Is that part of the reason, in your view, that we don't have the right spending in the right places today?
No, actually, I think the problem is much more with Congress. You see Congress, for example, I'll call it meddling in defense spending, deciding that they're going to keep programs in place that the military wants to get rid of. Here's a case where I would agree with Larry that, you know, we can be smarter. But the trouble is you have Congress holding on to old B-1s, requiring that we re-engine the C-5, the old transport, even though we have a newer one, the C-17, to provide us with transportation. And what you get is then this struggle between local interests at depots, at air bases, at army bases, and the national interest. And that becomes more of a problem than the military industrial or the industrial complex, which tends to be very passive, actually, and goes along in many cases with what the government and even Congress wants.
But isn't Congress essentially Lawrence Korb, directly representing that industrial complex? I mean, it's businesses in their home districts that they're going to bat for when it comes to military contracts, isn't it, Larry?
Well, there's no doubt about it. And that's why you need a president who was willing, like Eisenhower, to basically lay it on the table. Because you got to remember what happened in Eisenhower's first year when he basically gave the military what he called the remainder after we did all of the other things we needed to do in the federal government. It upset the chiefs of staff, particularly the Army chiefs, because he focused more on the Air Force in terms of deterrence. He was able, when Congress tried to do that, he basically said, hey, I know a little bit about war. You know, I'm a general and everything. So they backed off. It was after the Sputnik launch that the dam broke, if you will, and people made all these exaggerated claims about bomber gaps and missile gaps that defense spending started to increase. And that's why in his, you know, upon leaving office, he gave the talk about the military-industrial congressional complex, because he knew that there was no bomber gap and there was no missile gap, but people were using that in order to fund programs that he did not think made a great deal of sense.
So where do you see us then today? Just in the very biggest terms, Lawrence Korb, you say the right choices haven't been made. Are you suggesting that our spending is at about the right level if the right choices were made? It's under 4% of GDP. Is that about right for the United States of America? Or should it be less? I mean, how do you see it?
Sure. I think that you can spend less, for example, on nuclear weapons. I mean, you can easily cut the nuclear weapons budget in half. And based upon, you know, the best estimates, we're spending a little over $20 billion a year on that. We talked about systems. Dan is right. The Army needs these mine-resistant vehicles over there, but that's not in the baseline budget. That's in the supplemental. The Army has this future combat systems, which is basically designed to fight not an insurgency, but designed to fight a conventional battle. That's a $160 billion program. I support the Army and the Marines adding manpower and developing peacekeeping and stabilization divisions, but not that type of a system at the rate that they want. Similarly, we are building a new aircraft. It's called the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35. That's where we ought to emphasize it rather than a weapon system, but it's too, you know what I mean, the FA-22. This administration wanted to cap it at 183. The Air Force wants to go up to 380.
Of the F-22,
rather than making a decision, you know, to close the line this year, which was the original intent, they basically said, okay, we're going to leave it open, leave it to the next administration, which then is an invitation to the Congress to keep building them, even when, you know, Secretary Rumsfeld, Secretary Gates, Deputy Secretary England, you know, who are running, are running the Pentagon right now, think we have enough.
And explicitly saying, no, thank you. Dan Garay, I want to come down to that granularity, but first up at this very, very high level, Ronald Reagan in his inaugural there saying we've always got to be ready for every kind of conflict. But is there a point at which we cannot afford as a country to spend as much as we are? And what about the utility of all this? I mean, the case gets made that if you look at examples of warfare since World War II, it doesn't work out very well. It's not a very effective tool of foreign policy. And if you're spending hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in prep for it, you're going to do it, but it doesn't really work anymore.
Well, actually, the military works very well in a number of different roles, including major conflict. We can think of the first Gulf War. It works for deterrence purposes.
But couldn't you say the first Gulf War just set up the second Gulf War? Now here we are spending endlessly in that war while bridges fall down in Minnesota.
Well, in fact, one can have both bridges in Minnesota and defense spending at 4% of GDP or 4.5, somewhere in that range. One can have the kind of military you're talking about, including, I suppose, Larry's peacekeeping divisions. Mm-hmm. One can have the forces that can go in to help tsunami victims in Indonesia. One can have the forces that are in Afghanistan fighting with against the Taliban. So in a sense, you can have that range of capabilities. Most of the U.S. military forces, in fact, do contribute to that range of capabilities. The aircraft carrier isn't only for launching airstrikes. It also launches humanitarian missions. A C-17 can carry troops. It can also carry relief supplies, on and on. So, and in fact, other than some particular areas, high-end fighters, nuclear weapons, most of the U.S. military not only can be multifunctional, but we've used it in multifunctional ways around the world,
you say,
including
we can,
things like the V-22.
Yeah, you say, in effect, that we can afford it all. But let me just ask you on that front. I mean, first of all, we see all the infrastructure issues unaddressed in this country. And now here we are at the presidential campaign level. So everything kind of feeds up to one perspective of consideration. And then we're talking about this F-22, very, very expensive aircraft that people talk about in terms of a potential conflict one day with China. And we're already borrowing so much from China. Let me just ask you, Dan, how does that work? If China is essentially then lending us money to support our military, I mean, we never would have imagined we would have borrowed money in the Cold War from the Soviet Union. How does this make sense? Can we really afford it if we're having to borrow trillions from China, a potential adversary?
Well, the question isn't can we afford it. It is really the question of whether or not we have sufficient military capability to dissuade the Chinese should they decide at some point in the future that a military option is what they want with respect to Taiwan or some other place. It's not a question of—
Does that work
of,
when they're kind of, in one sense, when they're paying for it?
Well, in fact, the Chinese are building a military that is largely geared, in fact, to trying to go against the U.S. military. They're developing advanced weapons of all kinds of varieties. They did their own anti-satellite launch well before we did recently, all designed essentially to take our military down. So if we're looking at a country, whether we have trade relations with them or not, that is, in fact, building a military specifically geared to going against ours, one has to ask the question, shouldn't we have the capability to ensure that they're dissuaded from that course of action?
Larry Korb, is that ability real if we build all the planes and all the equipment, if they're being paid for out of borrowing from the Beijing's treasury? I mean, maybe it's a stupid question. I'm just a regular American citizen, but something about that formula seems out of whack to me.
Well, I agree. Now, let me give you a scenario which could happen. Let's say the Chinese, for whatever reason, decide that they're going to take Taiwan back by force, and the American president does what previous presidents do. We start moving aircraft carriers into the area.
Yeah.
And the Chinese say if those carriers come within 100 miles, 50 miles of Taiwan, we're going to dump our dollars and buy euros. Mm. You think the subprime mortgage lending thing is going to cause problems. This would cause havoc in this country. And so national security is not just a function of military power. It's a function of an economic consideration. And, you know, listening to Reagan's speech there, what would you have thought if at the end that he said, and we're going to borrow money from the Soviets because I want to cut taxes? This is the first war, extended war, we've ever fought, where we not only have not raised taxes to pay for it, we've actually cut them. It's also the first war, a long war we've ever had where we haven't had conscription. And so you can't have it all. If you want to, you know, don't want to have conscription, well, then you better pay your taxes so we can, you know, pay the $1 billion a year to get, men and women to join the Army.
Tom is calling from Montgomery, Vermont. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having this discussion. I'm calling because I'm pretty much sick and tired of the mindset that's largely being expressed by the one speaker, especially who used to work for the Reagan administration. It's
I'm not sure. Maybe Dan Gray is saying we've got to spend it because this is what Americans expect.
Well, yeah, exactly. And if you spend it and you simultaneously try and prevent and prepare for war at the same time, it's ultimately going to come to the same, you know, conclusion, which is going to war. And now, I mean, it's probably the 10th time that he's brought up going to war with China, possibly, you know, which is, yeah, it's a possibility. But if you try and outspend China, you know, militarily, 10 years down the line, you're going to have tons of military power and you're going to end up using it. And it's sort of the same, no one's learning from things like Vietnam and Iraq. When you simultaneously prevent and prepare for war, you're going to go to war when you're prepared for it. So it's, I sort of just wanted to add that to the mix.
Tom, let me ask you. You know, it's often been said, Ronald Reagan often said, you don't go to war. If you prepare for it, that means you don't have to go to war because nobody challenges you. What do you think of that, Tom?
You're asking me that question.
Yes.
I think, you know, ideas like reducing the nuclear power is a great idea, and not really bickering over, you know, what models of planes that we should be buying. I think ultimately when you look at the problems within this country and the amount of money that my and everybody's tax money goes towards the military, I want to say it's like 75% of the taxes you pay goes to strengthening the military, and we still, you know, we haven't reduced the amount of problems in the world because of our military. Yeah, we're involved in most of them, but that's because we are involved in most of them, and
right,
because we spend that much money on the military, you're going to go use it.
Tom, you put a lot on the table there. Thanks very much for your call. Dan Gray, let me come to you. First of all, Tom says, quit bringing up China as a bogeyman here. You'll push us toward war with them, and you know, if you spend this much, you're inevitably going to use it, but look around the world. Do we have fewer problems?
Well, in fact, in some cases, we do have fewer problems. It was Ronald Reagan and his willingness to spend on defense, among other things, that brought down the Soviet Union, that forced them essentially into capitulation. Not a small victory for the U.S. military and for significant defense spending.
And now Russia's rich and it's back and people are talking about a new Cold War.
They're talking about a new Cold War. We're not. They are, in fact, the ones trying to. And, in fact, if that's the case, if they're the ones now pushing nuclear weapons, pushing an aggressive military stance, hardly the time for us to stop spending on the U.S. military and essentially turn over that advantage to a Russia that is quite militant.
Larry Korb, what about the percent of American taxes that go to our national defense budget? Do you know it offhand?
Well, basically, the defense, I mean, the national budget is divided into two areas, one which you call uncontrollable programs that or entitlements that you're entitled, Social Security, Medicare, military retirement, civil service retirement, all of those things.
Obligations, yep.
Right. Then that's about two-thirds of the federal budget. One-third of the budget, what we call discretionary spending, the defense budget is close to 60% of that if you put in the supplements.
60% of what's left over after all the rest. Then what about our caller in Vermont says, you know, I don't want to spend that much. I think it leads us in the wrong direction. But Dan Gray says that the Americans, you know, they want and expect a military that can reach out and do the necessary, whatever that's decided to be, whenever it's decided to be necessary. Do you agree that that's the American mainstream view, expectation of the U.S. military?
Well, I agree that the American people want a military to protect our national security. My concern is that we're not making wise choices. For example, if you take a look at the 09 budget, the baseline budget that was sent up to the Congress, the Army, Air Force, and Navy all get one-third. That is not making hard choices. It seems to me right now, given the threats and what the president calls the global war on terror, the Army ought to be getting more, the Air Force less. You know, it's very interesting. In today's Washington Post, the Air Force is actually going to spend money to tell people that we're still relevant. Well, the Army didn't run an advertising campaign in the 50s when the Air Force was – Eisenhower was spending half the budget on the Air Force. And that's what I think is the problem. You have to take a look at what you're trying to do, what your threats are, and make these hard choices.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at another real issue behind the 08 campaign, America's giant defense spending, now at its highest level in constant dollar since World War II and asking how much should we spend on defense and for what. Former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, Lawrence Korb, is with us. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Daniel Gray is here, vice president of the Lexington Institute in Washington. He's former director of the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Defense Department during the first term of President George W. Bush. Tina's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Tina. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You bring up a good point that we borrow money so much from other countries like Japan, China, or British government. And we about to be $9 trillion in debt to those countries. And we are thinking, we have to rethink about how we're going to spend this money. We cannot go on borrowing people. We have to think about the social security that's coming up. We have to think about the education about people in this country. We have to think about Medicare that this administration has been cut all the time.
But don't we still need a strong defense, even if we've got a big debt, Tina?
How can we defend this country if people in this country cannot pay for the medical bill and people in this country don't have good education? I think that people have to rethink how we can protect our country, our people.
Let me put it to both of our guests. Larry Korb, first to you. What do you make of Tina's perspective?
Well, I think she makes a good point that, in fact, the well-being of the country is not just on military spending. Go back to Eisenhower. That's why he said we've got to take care of our other needs first, and then we'll give the remainder to defense because you can't buy perfect security no matter how much you spend. And then he made choices in there in terms of cutting the Army down, putting more money into the Air Force because he felt that was the best way to deter the Soviet Union. Eisenhower's greatest legacy, if you look at his papers and everything, is the interstate highway system. And he said, you know, that's really, you know, what we need. And I think that's the question. Now, if people believe, like Dan does, and I think that's certainly a legitimate point of view, okay, we need to, then let's raise taxes to do it because we got the worst of all possible worlds now because we're borrowing money to do this. You know, President Reagan raised defense spending in his first 4 years in office. After that, he cut it because the deficit got too big. The first President Bush, when he came in, even before the Cold War ended in 1989, recognizing the deficit, told then, you know, Secretary Cheney, I want you to cut $30 billion right now before you send the budget up. And again, these are the choices that we have to make.
Dan Gray, what do you say to our caller Tina's view of the world? She says, we've got a lot of debt and a lot of problems that need spending. We can't afford to go on at this level on this front.
In fact, it's a false dichotomy. The notion that it's defense spending that's causing this problem is actually simply wrong. You have a huge entitlement issue. In fact, we're only spending of the federal budget 12% on defense. You're spending more on entitlements, vastly more, and that number is likely to grow astronomically. If we want to talk about,
but entitlements aren't just thrown off the planet. I mean, that's people's health, that's people's retirement income. Those are real and important, presumably, things to take care of.
They are real and important, but they need to be addressed with the same kind of laser vision that Larry wants to apply to defense spending, which is you cannot go on with open-ended entitlements either. Just like you have insurance policies, medical insurance or old age insurance in our entitlement side, we frankly should treat defense as an insurance policy and be willing to pay a reasonable amount to ensure you have the military that will provide reasonable security. We can argue about a particular program, but in fact, argue about F-22, argue about nuclear programs, that's really small potatoes in a $500 billion defense budget. By and large, every one of the candidates, every past president has spent very close to what it took to keep this military going and functioning, or at least as close as they could possibly get.
We've got a lot of listeners who want in there. Let's go to Battle Creek, Michigan, and Jim. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. How you doing?
Well, what do you see, Jim?
I'm all for spending money on the military because that's what we need. My big issue is the waste that these companies take advantage of us and charge, you know, way too much for the products. Because they can. If we had more of a control on that, our dollar could actually get stretched farther versus wasting it and spending three times as much for stuff.
Tighter control, tighter observation of what goes on with defense contractors. Hold that thought, Jim. Let me get one more call here from Atkinson, New Hampshire. Donald, you're on the air. It looks like you may have something to add there.
Yes. My thing is to address the same problems, the inefficiency in the system. And I think the fact that things cost three times more than they should is because of the procurement regulations, the export restrictions, you know, caused by ITAR, and the fact that the defense companies have to hire this cadre of retired, congressional officials, defense, you know.
Donald, I see a note here that says that says you are in defense consulting. What do you see from the work that you do, Donald?
Well, there's two aspects of it. One is you know, how to go about getting one of those earmarks, which is only a couple $1 million. But the real waste in the system is with the big contractors, you know, having to hire all the retired generals, the lobbyists, congressional officials, and spread the jobs around to the right districts. When I'm looking at how to get something funded, the first thing I start with is a list on who's on the Appropriations Committee and see if we can put the work in those states.
So do you see that lobbying as somehow ending up bumping up the price tag for the U.S. taxpayer or cutting into our military's effectiveness?
Well, it's why you can't, once a project gets to a certain level of funding, and the military doesn't want it, but it keeps being funded, is because there's this momentum caused by the money being spent in key states.
And on it goes.
It's a system that just feeds on itself. So, I mean, there's a number of projects, you know, you want to cancel, but you just can't do it because you've got to face down, you know, an entire congressional delegation, you know, with a fair amount of clout, and they're going to take, you know, they're going to take their pound of flesh from something you want to do. So,
right. Donald, we appreciate that your insight there. Dan Garay, our caller in Battle Creek, says, wasteful, overcharging defense contractors. And Donald, who works on the inside, says, you know, the price of lobbying to get that earmark, we end up just paying a lot more than we ought to, for perhaps less than we should get.
There's no question, Tom, that the acquisition system, that is the system by which we buy major military hardware, is broken. You've seen efforts in this administration to try and find a way of bringing commercial practices in.
Yeah.
The Littoral Combat Ship was supposed to be a cheap ship. Turned out, once the Navy applied all its rules to the process, it turned out to be a very expensive ship. You have the Armed Reconnaissance Helicopter, which is a version of a commercial helicopter. The idea was to try and use commercial rules, commercial practices. Once the military rulemakers got a hold of it, all these programs simply skyrocketed. There has to be a way of changing the procurement system. In fact, if I was going to point to one thing that any of the candidates ought to be addressing, it's not the overall defense budget. That's going to stay fairly high for all the reasons we can talk about. It's the acquisition system. That is, figuring out a way of making it affordable and effective to buy the weapons we want, the weapons we need, is the crucial thing that will keep us out of some sort of bankruptcy if that's where we're heading for.
But if that hasn't been done in all these years, Larry Korb, is the U.S. public just, being run through the ringer here and in the end not getting the defense they deserve and not getting the infrastructure improvements or whatever else might be done with that money?
Well, it has been done on occasion, and I think the key reason that this administration was actually worse than any others, at least in its first several years, is because the Deputy Secretary of Defense, this is the man or woman who has to manage the world's largest organization, was not a manager. It was Paul Wolfowitz, who's a great academic and great thinker, not a manager. After Vietnam, when Richard Nixon came in, they cut the defense budget. People, as Mark Shields calls him our last liberal president, he cut defense and put the money into
Richard
a lot
Nixon.
Of social, quote, like EPA, OSHA, Amtrak. But what he did is his deputy secretary of defense was David Packard, and he got the system under control. And as Dan pointed out, he wouldn't let the services, override him on particular things. I think when Dick Cheney was there under the first President Bush and they had Don Atwood, who came from General Motors, they did a good job. So that's the key thing. It's not going to be easy, but you've got to ensure that the person who becomes the Deputy Secretary of Defense knows how to do it, and you got about a year to do it. After that, it's going to be very, very, very difficult. I mean, and I think that's the key thing. Even Republicans in Congress will say they've never seen the cost growth as bad as it has been particularly in the first years of the Bush administration.
Let's get a call from Watertown, Massachusetts, and Stephen. Hi, Stephen, you're on the air.
Well, I'm just really surprised that you've heard nary a peep from particularly the Democratic campaign presidential contenders.
Not much conversation on this, given the scale of the issues and the budget.
No, and particularly, you know, they're talking about, you know, universal health care, beefing up social infrastructure. I mean, they talk about tax rollbacks for.
Why do you think we haven't heard more on defense spending?
I think it's the third rail, still somewhat. I think they're really leery about being perceived as being, you know, soft on defense. I mean, I was really sort of amazed after the budget numbers were released, and Barack Obama is trying to sort of philosophically differentiate himself from Hillary Clinton as being sort of beyond the mindset that brought us this war, that he, you know, didn't sort of exploit what I think many Democrats see as a, you know, staggering blow and a drain on other social programs. I mean, in the general election, I could, you know, I could foresee a lot more tentativeness. Tom, I also think it's worth noting that you were talking about utility and you know, well, what is the value of being military rich and diplomacy poor? For instance, when the U.S. can't even hold its NATO allies to its commitments in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, there it is again. That takes it. Thank you, Stephen, for your call. I mean, it brings up the political conversation around this and this issue of utility. But let's go to the political conversation first. Dan Gray, what do you make of the conversation on the campaign trail? Do you hear what needs to be raised? Are you surprised that Democrats aren't looking more vociferously at this very large defense spending and how else it might be spent? Do you expect, do you wish for something else in the debate over defense spending?
Look, there clearly needs to be a sharper debate. In fact, if you go online and look at the various websites for the campaigns, you find that the one with the sharpest position, including on reducing wasteful spending in defense, is John McCain. Second, you have Barack Obama, but he talks primarily, at least again on the official site, about doing sort of not more, but spending issues, that is, armor and healthcare and training and other things.
In other words, spending enough to make sure the troops have armor and healthcare.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. But he talks about things that he wants to give them, not the hard choices that Larry talks about. And if you look at Hillary Clinton, at least as far as the official side goes, it's just about zero, which is stunning given her claims on competence and experience and her position on the Armed Services Committee.
Larry Korb, what would you like to hear on the campaign trail that you are not, that you haven't so far on this large issue?
Well, what I'd like the candidates to say is national security is not just defense. It's also homeland security, and if you will, which is defense and prevention, which is in the State Department. And I'd like to see them have a unified national security budget where we look at the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, and the State Department together. Now, let me give you an example of what I mean. Right now, we spend more on national missile defense, which is one program in the Department of Defense, which is to theoretically protect us against a nuclear strike from another country.
Yep.
We spend more on that than the entire Coast Guard. Well, if I'm going to worry about, you know, setting priorities, I think if somebody wants to put a nuclear weapon in this country, they're much more liable to try and sneak it in than shoot it at us with a return address. We don't get to make those trade-offs now because you got the Department of Defense, you know, one pocket, the, you know, Homeland Security where the Coast Guard is another, and the State Department another. Even Secretary Gates says we don't spend enough on prevention or the State Department and things like foreign aid. And that's what I'd like to see them say. We're going to look at all those together, and then whatever number we decide upon, we're going to make those trade-offs.
Let's try and get another caller to Charles in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Charles, you're on the air.
Hello. When I think about defense policy, the thing that always occurs to me is, I think it was Horace who said those who desire peace should prepare for war. And the idea that we should somehow cut funding for defense is, I think, far too optimistic, because we do live in a dangerous world, and what kept us at mostly at peace during the Cold War was the overwhelming threat of retaliation. And as long as you have that threat of retaliation, you can at least have some degree of peace within your home.
We've retaliated pretty fiercely in Iraq and Afghanistan. How's that going so far?
Obviously, there have been mistakes. Afghanistan was foolishly administered by someone who, well, let's be honest, Rumsfeld was incompetent. But the simple fact is, Iraq wasn't retaliation. Iraq was an aggressive war, and so you can make the argument that it was somehow a preemptive war, and that's that's not classic force doctrine.
So, but be strong, you say, but then do the right thing with that strength, and we've seen how difficult that is to do. Larry Korb, the 4% of GDP that Dan Gray and others point to as the right level for defense spending long term, do you agree with that? Is that
I think you ought to take a look at what you need and make the decisions. You know, people who talk about that, I say, well, what will you do if the GDP goes down and your threat goes up? No, I've always been opposed to that. You shouldn't have you ought to take a look at what you need and then make the decisions. The call is right. You try to fight the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq on the cheap. If you had told the American people ahead of time, particularly about Iraq, what the cost would be, I don't think they would have supported it. But they claimed we'd be greeted as liberators and we'd be down to 30,000 troops by the end of 2003. You didn't have enough for forces. And of course, then you took some out of Afghanistan to fight there, and then you undermined Afghanistan, and now we have the worst of all possible worlds.
Well, and great big bills still to come, but as Dan Gray says, it's got to be paid for, yet the country's sitting and watching the utility of some of these interventions, and question marks dance on that front. Fascinating hour. I wish we heard more of this from the campaigns themselves. Perhaps we will as we move toward the general election. Lawrence Korb with the Center for American Progress, I want to thank you very much for being with us this hour.
It's great to be with you and Dan.
And Dan Gray, Vice President at the Lexington Institute in Washington. Dan, thanks for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.